KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
Health is impossible when living in systems of oppression. We cannot effectively treat diseases like diabetes with a drug without addressing the systems that makes diabetes so prevalent. We must redefine the scope of healthcare workers and the work of healthcare to include not only care at the bedside of the individual, but dismantling the systems of oppression that create the conditions for illness. And finally, we must reintegrate with the earth, with each other, and within ourselves. We must decolonize.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
We stand at the threshold of a historic opportunity in the human experiment to reimagine how to live on Earth in ways that honor the web of life, each other, and future generations. It's a revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart. In this series, we celebrate social and scientific innovators with breakthrough solutions for restoring people and planet, creating a future environment of hope. When we hear the word health, it's usually framed as personal health. The implication is that health is our personal responsibility. Diet, exercise, stress reduction, and the menu of healthy lifestyle choices we're individually obligated to make. But what about the reality that a newborn baby today carries as many as 280 synthetic chemicals in her body? Or that according to several meta-studies, 70 to 90% of cancers are directly related to toxic exposures in the environment or the workplace. These are not personal choices. These realities are the result of decisions made without our consent as citizens, or often even our knowledge. The living biological truth is that human health is dependent upon the health of nature's ecosystems. While the social truth is that we're all involuntary subjects in a mass medical experiment gone terribly wrong. Since the 1990s, a growing global movement of concerned scientists, doctors, public health advocates, and others have been advancing a new medical paradigm, ecological medicine. Ecological medicine anchors public health in the health of ecosystems. After all, the great health advances of the 19th century had little to do with medical care and everything to do with public health measures. Maintaining clean water supplies and quarantining the sick resulted in steep declines in diseases. In this half hour, Dr. Rupa Maria expands upon ecological medicine to encompass what she calls social medicine. As Associate Professor of Medicine at UC San Francisco and Faculty Director of the Do No Harm Coalition, she says we need to dismantle the harmful social structures that directly lead to poor health outcomes and build new structures that promote health and healing. In other words, we'll improve our health by changing society. This is Social Medicine, Restoring Public Health by Changing Society. I'm Neil Harvey. I'll be your host. Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
I am the daughter of Punjabi immigrants who came to this country in 1973 with little money but plenty of caste privilege. We grew up with family vacations driving around a VW van around the western lands. And my father would stop at the reservations where he would make us get out and listen and learn and look and see what had happened to the original people of this land. He would talk to me about colonization because we are also a people who had been colonized by Europeans.
Dr. Rupa Maria sees her role as a physician in the much larger context of identity and what constitutes true health and health care. She spoke at a Bioneers conference.
I am a mother of two beautiful mixed heritage boys, and I am a farmer's wife. I am a physician who works in adult medicine, and who witnesses society's ills manifest in my patients' bodies, and a doctor who sees racism and state violence as an urgent public health issue. I am a touring musician who has played in 29 different countries, singing in 5 different languages with the band Rupa and the April Fishes. And to use a phrase taught to me by Miwok elder Wounded Knee, I am an earth person. What I'm going to describe for you today is a system of domination in which we live, and what I believe are the direct health consequences of that system for all of us. Today, we will be talking about the impact of social stressors, which have been shown to cause chronic inflammation. These diseases require more systemic approaches, not simply focusing on the individual, but rather moving our gaze to the structures of society, helping us see how the individual pursuit of health is actually futile in a system that makes health impossible.
As a practicing physician, Rupa Marya examines how social structures can predispose disadvantaged groups to certain illnesses. During a conversation at a Bioneers conference, she shared a medical lesson she learned while farming.
So I married this wonderful farmer, and he's teaching me a lot about growing things. And when we moved onto our property in Oakland, the orange tree had rust on it. And I was like, let's get the neem oil. Let's put things on it. It was my doctor's mind. Like, let's zap this thing. And he's like, let's put some compost. Let's pitchfork the soil around it. Let's give this tree some love. And I learned so much very humbly from him, because that sense of caretaking is very different than the sense that I was trained with. And so as I have worked in the hospital and seen people come back with recurrent, sometimes deadly infections, the question is, what can we do for that person to increase their immunity and increase their health, restore their wellness so that their body can resist and fight these things rather than keep slamming people with antibiotics that can have untoward effect? In dire situations in the ICU or when someone's deathly ill, you go for the antibiotic. When they're not there, but they're still not in a place of health, how do you restore those systems? And I think that we are not trained in a way to be creative thinkers as medicine people in this context of a capitalist, profit-driven medical system, which is why I feel it is deeply unethical, because we have so much more at our disposal, so much more science available, so much more thinking available that could be used to help serve our patients in the overall general health of our populations, not just the poor and indigent, but everybody.
Dr. Marya points out that because preventative medicine isn't profitable, it's marginalized in the capitalist medical model. Over 60% of all bankruptcies filed in the U.S. are tied to medical debt. Just one serious health problem can push a family into poverty or homelessness. And now that the climate crisis has become a permanent emergency, the ER has to confront a new existential emergency, radically escalating and unprecedented medical challenges.
I was working at the hospital the days that San Francisco reached 106 degrees, and the emergency room looked like a war zone. There were people in stretchers lining the halls. We had people coming in having heart attacks who had completely clean coronaries. We had people having bone marrow suppression from heat exhaustion, and the hospital halls were so hot that people who were febrile with fevers went to the ICU because they were, just the ambient heat of the room was, it just made this catastrophic series of events in their own bodies. And we actually have a case that came up of a woman who was admitted, had a fever. It got so high because her room was 95 degrees in the room. She went to the ICU. She ended up dying. And it's come up as a morbidity and mortality case. And they called me to talk about the case. And I was like, we need to talk about how we are unprepared for climate change. And through that experience, it's pushing us now as health practitioners, at least on the front lines in the hospitals, to start asking these questions a little bit more desperately. So I'm hearing hospital administrators talk about, oh, this is climate change and we are unprepared. I'd never seen that kind of acknowledgement. I'm hearing doctors talk about capitalism as a health problem.
Dr. Rupa Maria also knows that one critical factor in health and healing is the strength of our social relationships. So instead of the doctor knows best, top-down approach, what happens when doctors, patients, and their families come together in community to discuss the patient's health in the larger context of the social and political environment?
So I had a 50-year-old mom, African-American woman, who was in the hospital for her fifth or sixth exacerbation of lung disease from smoking crack. And this time she had smoked crack, it was laced with levamisol, which is a antiparasitic that caused this inflammation of her blood vessels. And I had to get it through to her that if she did that again, it could be lethal. It had affected the blood vessels around her heart. And so we called a family meeting. I sat down and I called her family in, and we talked about the history of crack use in the African-American community as a direct outcome of the genocidal project in the United States. And we talked about how this is a legacy that extends from the time of slavery in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we talked about how this pattern for her was not simply a burden of her as an individual, but was a pattern that was a social pattern. And it was amazing to see her load lifted and her perspective widened and her family's perspective widened. Her kids, who were in their 20s, were very already down with this narrative. But to hear it coming from her health provider in a hospital was actually a very healing act. And she has informed me, and she continues to inform me, that she's been clean ever since. She hasn't gone back to smoking crack. Okay. And I think that to me is remarkable, that if we can just start to reframe how we are thinking, we can shift the balance for many different kinds of people. We can empower them with the knowledge and the stories that can help them to heal themselves.
One place Dr. Rupa Maria has witnessed the stress and health effects from the trauma of injustice is in the disproportionate rates of police violence in Black, Latinx, and Native American communities. Realities like these inspired her to help create the Do No Harm Coalition at UCSF. The coalition of healers, health workers, and activists arose after 26-year-old Mario Woods was gunned down by the San Francisco Police Department in late 2015.
So I started organizing with a group of medical students when we were taking care of a group of five people who were protesting police violence in San Francisco, the Frisco Five. So they went on hunger strike and sat out in front of the Mission Police Department protesting the killing of Black and brown and mentally ill people in San Francisco by the San Francisco Police Department with no accountability, no transparency in the investigation, and no justice for the killings. So we started organizing around this idea that police violence is a public health issue and that racism and state violence are public health issues because they not only affect the bodies of our patients and the people who are left behind, but it also, when there is no accountability for this violence, it erodes the very civic fabric that we rely on, the trust between governance and individuals. And I feel like this is, you know, where we are at as a society right now, is really seeing that threadbare nature of how there's so much distrust between different communities and the state institutions. So we're starting to articulate a language around this, and then using this language in the hospitals as we're seeing patients, and also out in the communities.
That work led Dr. Maria and her colleagues to launch the Justice Study. It's a national project designed to answer the question, if the wound is police violence and the medicine is justice, what happens to the well-being of families and communities who don't receive that medicine? Societal wounds like state violence create severe harms in both body and mind. Dr. Maria calls the state of physical and psychic siege the colonial syndrome. It manifests in alarmingly high rates of heart disease, cancer, obesity, and diabetes. It's exponentially more devastating for populations who've endured transgenerational harms and injustices that stem from legacies of colonialism, violence, and genocide. To address the societal root causes of these chronic afflictions, Dr. Rupa Maria says we have to examine the colonial foundations of our societies.
To me, To be colonized means to be disconnected and disintegrated from our ancestry, from our earth, from our indigeneity, our earth-connected selves. We all come from earth-connected peoples. Colonization is the way the extractive economic system of capitalism came to this land, supported by systems of supremacy and domination, which are a necessary part to keep the wealth and power accumulated in the hands of the colonizers and ultimately their financiers. In what we now know as the United States, this system of supremacy is expressed in many ways. First, white supremacy, which created a framework that legitimized slavery and genocide. Slavery created cheap labor, which is necessary for a functioning capitalist system, and genocide created unlimited access to resources. Now, we all know that white supremacy is the scary guy with the swastika and the hood, right? But it can also look like any place where there is an abundance of white people in exclusive contexts, where power and access is not readily ceded to others. And these systems are what need to be dismantled.
As the late Audre Lorde stated, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. So what might a new re-indigenized vision of holistic healthcare look like? And how might we get there?
To heal the diseases that are caused by the trauma of colonization, we must decolonize. If colonization represents a disintegration and a disconnection, we must reconnect. And our work is two-pronged, to reintegrate and to dismantle. We must reintegrate what has been divided and conquered in our societies, between our peoples, between us and the natural world around us, and within ourselves. And we can do this in many ways, by promoting acts that increase local autonomy and self-determinism, by exposing the myth of treating the individual as limited in its ability to actually address root causes of diseases, by reconnecting to who we were before our respective colonization through songs, traditional knowledge, reawakening our food and medicine ways, and reawakening our relationships to each other, to the earth around us, and to other beings. And we must dismantle those systems of domination that create and recreate cycles of trauma and inflammation, those systems that work in service of capitalism. This is my vision of holistic healthcare.
For Dr. Rupa Maria, decolonizing medicine also means using what she calls her white coat privilege to assist communities to reclaim their health by seeking justice and equality. When we return, we hear how a new re-indigenized vision of holistic healthcare has begun to manifest in a breakthrough collaboration on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. This is Social Medicine, Restoring Public Health by Changing Society. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Rise, you fallen fighters. Rise and take your stance again. She who learns to run away lives to fight another day.
You can see and hear more from Rupa Maria and explore more Bioneers radio programs, podcasts, and videos online at bioneers.org. For information on attending the National Bioneers Conference and Bioneers events in your area, please visit bioneers.org or call 1-877-BIONEER. Dr. Rupa Maria has studied and seen firsthand the harmful effects of colonization on health outcomes. But it wasn't until she was invited to the Standing Rock Reservation that Rupa understood how much the eradication of cultural identity and traditional cosmologies have continued to traumatize successive generations following the original genocide and colonization of Native Americans that began over 500 years ago. The movement to stop the Keystone XL oil pipeline drew thousands of people to the Standing Rock Reservation to help defend the indigenous and other communities living near the path of the proposed project. As they peacefully protested, these water protectors faced a brutal response from the police and private paramilitary security corporations.
What I experienced there as a healthcare provider, to me, was striking. You know, I had always known about the genocide of Native people growing up in this land. I was born in Ohlone territory. So I was always aware of it as a young person. And it wasn't until I was at Standing Rock and witnessed the violence of the police that I understood how this is actually an ongoing process, that the genocide is continuing and that it has these very deep ramifications, not just for Native people who are experiencing it after several centuries, but also for those of us who are standing with them, and also for the perpetrators of the violence.
Dr. Maria was invited to interview Indigenous elders. She asked them this: what does decolonized medicine mean to you? What does health mean to you? What does medicine mean to you? She says their responses illustrated a very different worldview, especially one from an elder, a woman named Candace Ducheneau.
She calls the white people Washichu, which means the one who take all the fat. That's the word that the Lakota used to describe white folks. What has Washichu medicine ever given us? Before they came, we didn't have diabetes, we didn't have cancer, we didn't have heart disease, because we lived with our medicine around us all the time. The plants were our medicine. The animals were our medicine. Our community was our medicine. The way we moved and lived together was our medicine. And our medicine people lived right with us. So you didn't go see a doctor when you were sick. You were always putting yourself into balance. So their very way of existing, it's completely opposite to what they're living now, with no movement, no communal living in this certain way. And the relationships to their ecosystems and their food systems have been completely disrupted by the flooding of the Missouri River after it was dammed and when they were put onto reservations.
Colonization drove not only the destruction of landscapes, it also sought to eradicate traditional indigenous worldviews of health as wholeness, interdependence, and balance.
On the Standing Rock Reservation, before the damming of Minnesota or the Missouri River, diabetes was rare. Actually, diabetes was virtually non-existent. Once the river was dammed, it ended up flooding these cottonwood forests. By shifting the ecology through a colonizing force, the people became more dependent on the cash economy for their food and medicine, and lost the essential cultural connection to their traditional ways. This tragic loss of the commons is a hallmark of capitalist society, and the impact is felt in the individual body. After the damming of the river, rates of diabetes skyrocketed. This didn't happen simply because people became more sedentary and consequently more obese. This happened because of colonization, not by changing the indigenous body, but by changing the social structures around that body, which in turn creates disease.
But today, a cultural and political renaissance among many indigenous tribes and communities is starting to challenge and reverse the destruction, to reimagine what healing looks like, and to build the structures and relationships to grow a new model. With her team, Dr. Maria began to collaborate with Lakota Dakota health leaders to explore how they could collectively create structures and systems to help improve health outcomes and strengthen community resilience. The overriding questions: how do you decolonize medicine? And what does healing look like when personal health, ecological well-being, and social justice are the core values for public health systems?
We've decided that we would like to create a partnership to create this clinic and farm. And some of the things that we have decided we absolutely want for this space in order to decolonize medicine is to have a kitchen, traditional round structures, a waiting area. There will be a pharmacy that will have a formulary that will include the herbs and the medicines that we medical people use and to check their cross-reactivities. Interestingly, they wanted to have private exam rooms that could be big enough to fit a family. So the concept of privacy is very different in Lakota culture. Like, they want everyone in the exam room having the dialogue with them, because often illness is seen as a system issue. It's not just an individual. It's how these things are relating. They want to have a spiritual and ceremonial space integrated not as a side offshoot, but in central to the way this physical space will be. And they also want a children's area and an elders area. These are things that we don't commonly think of in a clinic. They would like to have a birthing center eventually. They want to have classrooms. They want to have housing. They want to have be off the grid. They want to have water recycling. So they really see that this clinic could be a vision for how they could be building and how they could be taking care of themselves. And for me, this clinic is really the greatest example of social medicine, because I believe that we cannot move forward as a society until we address our primary violence, which is against the Native people.
This emerging vision of social medicine is combining powerfully with ecological medicine's first principle, that human and environmental health are one notion, indivisible. It unites ancient worldviews of health as wholeness with practical contemporary public health models. The quest is to create new ways of doing medicine that can serve as an example for other communities. For Dr. Rupa Maurya, decolonizing medicine starts with reclaiming our power as citizens to create institutions and build an authentic democracy. In other words, she asks, how do we change society?
This same question goes to how do we encourage our citizens to actually make this place a democracy? How do we encourage people to take back the right to clean water? How do we encourage people the right to have access to land that they can make their food from without it being poisoned? These are all big questions. How do we start a revolution? What I want you to remember from this talk is this. Health is impossible when living in systems of oppression. We cannot effectively treat diseases like diabetes with a drug without addressing the systems that makes diabetes so prevalent. We must redefine the scope of healthcare workers and the work of healthcare to include not only care at the bedside of the individual, but dismantling the systems of oppression that create the conditions for illness. And finally, we must reintegrate with the earth, with each other, and within ourselves. We must decolonize.
Rupa Maurya, Social Medicine, Restoring Public Health by Changing Society. To explore more Bioneers radio programs, podcasts, and videos, visit bioneers.org. The Bioneers Revolution from the Heart of Nature is a production of Bioneers and Collective Heritage Institute. Executive producer, Kenny Ossibel. Written by Monica Lopez and Kenny Ossibel. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Our theme music is co-written by the Baka Forest People of Cameroon and Baka Beyond from the album East to West. Find out more at globalmusicexchange.org. Additional music was made by Rupa Maurya and the April Fishes at theaprilfishes.com. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 0518.
This program was made possible in part by Guayaki Yerba Mate, working with indigenous farmers in South America to grow shade-grown organic yerba mate to inspire us all to come to life. Learn more about Guayaki's products and regenerative mission at guayaki.com.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
Tough City Radio, your home at the end of the road, drawls the local radio station's DJ in a raspy whisper. He croons the long O sounds, releasing the words onto the airwaves as though they should have a sticker attached that reads, Caution, Fragile. Tough City Radio is a tiny independent station in Tofino, a town on the west coast of Vancouver Island, Canada. It's eclectic in its output. Free from the commercial pressures of nationwide or city-based radio stations, it eschews contemporary chart music and plays whatever it pleases, whenever it wants. Sometimes their DJs cut a song short if they feel it's trundling on too long. Sometimes they'll shift from a southern blues number to an epic psychedelic track. Years ago, I visited Tofino, a small famed surf town, with the intention of spending a month there, but in the end staying nearly a year. "This place grabs you, right?" is what the people there said. Venturesome Ontarians who have traded the Great Lakes for the Pacific Ocean. Restive Manitobans who have fled the vast plains of the prairies for the beaches and tree-blanketed mountains. Disillusioned Albertans who have swapped oil money trucks for beaten-up campervans. The inhabitants of the place are diverse as a Tough City radio playlist. When winter settles in, the rain comes, as inevitable as the tides. Deluges fall in biblical swathes. Unlike home, though, no talk of bad weather is tolerated unless a particularly destructive storm is arriving. Daily chit-chat relies on other subjects, surfing mainly, ice hockey when the playoffs commence, but seldom the weather. "Will it ever stop raining?" I said to one of my co-workers one November day. We stood inside the door of the surf shop, looking out at the rain as it was slavering from the maw of a massive grey cloud. "We're living in a rainforest. It's bound to rain," he said. He wasn't being sarcastic. He was matter of fact, showing a forbearance towards the downpour that I found unfathomable yet impressive. "Don your rain jacket, slip into your wellies, and just get on with things. That's the Tofitian way." And so the rain lashed against my sitting room window throughout the winter, and Tough City Radio droned on my small alarm clock radio that, in lieu of TV or Wi-Fi, was my sole entertainment system. After some time, I noticed that I had heard very few Irish acts on the station. I almost grew homesick for Bono's voice. One night early in the new year, my friend Luke, an Albertan who had grown up hunting and fishing, invited me to dig clams with him and his friend Carlos. Carlos belonged to the Tuquat First Nation, an indigenous people whose home reservation lies deep in a secluded inlet of Barclay Sound, an hour from Tofino. The night was cold, but rainless. The tide was low. We were careful to avoid digging on native land, skirting the border and ensuring we dug only in permissible territory. The moon was covered by a pall of impenetrable clouds, so we found our way using torches. After gathering the clams, we plucked oysters from adjacent beds, and Carlos told us that, in the past, warring tribes would use the beds as a kind of torture instrument. A captured warrior would be dragged on his back across the shard-like shells. Afterwards, we brought a portion of clams and oysters to Carlos's auntie, who lived with her husband in a timber frame bungalow on the reservation. She was a petite, curious woman and, before my arrival on her doorstep, had never met an Irish person. She invited us to have a drink with her. Over the hours that followed, we drank several more. I sat in the warm sitting room observing the artwork adorning the walls, eating home-cured candied salmon, drinking cans of Bud, listening to Carlos's many stories. He had travelled a lot. He had recently spent some time gallivanting in Mexico until he grew sick of himself and returned home to settle down, to finally grow up. I nodded along to everything he said. I could relate. Carlos's auntie lamented the loss of a pet dog. A predacious wolf had clenched it and stolen it away to the forest. She was worried now that her other dog would meet the same fate. Carlos told his auntie that he would shoot the wolf, but only if she really wanted him to. For a wolf, he said, was a noble creature. Sometime during the night, I was gifted a wooden mass carved by Carlos's cousin. It's on my bookshelf now, watching over me as I write. Then Carlos's uncle-in-law played the Pogues on YouTube, and the cosy bungalow in Barclay Sound along the 49th parallel suddenly felt like one near the Ox Mountains. It was even further than the end of the road of which the Duff City radio DJ spoke, but finally, I heard some music that reminded me of home. In the morning, as we drove away on a rutty logging road, the gleam of the rising sun dazzled the water of the sound. A gentle wind riffled the branches of the Douglas firs. Canadian geese filed by in the bay. It didn't rain that day either. But for the days that followed, the weeks, the rain fell as though the sky had been sundered.
You're listening to Tough City Radio, 90.1 FM. Taking you to your happy place. It's what's happening in your ears right now.
Jack is in love with EVs. He's infatuated. He recently bought a big SUV, all electric, needless to say. This was no ordinary set of wheels. Jack boasted that it had a range of 550 kilometers, even 600. Belfast and back, easy, he said. Unbelievable range. EV drivers are range obsessed. The driver of a traditional car doesn't immediately start to brag to you about how far the car can go before it stops. So when Jack said he was driving to France for 2 days and invited me along for the spin, the first thing I asked about was range. He looked at me. France is coming down with charging points, he said, but we won't need them. We'll get over and back on the charge I'll put in at home. In slanting sleet a few days later in Cherbourg, we disembarked from the ferry and headed for Mont-Saint-Michel, a journey of just under 2 hours. The dashboard battery icon read 95%. Our windscreen and rear window demisters were on full, as was the heater, the heated seats, the GPS, the radio, and, of course, the lights and the windscreen wipers. Jack wasn't hanging about. He powered us down the rain-swept motorway as the onboard map screen showed the nearest EV charging points. Dozens of them. Our B&B didn't have a charging point, and although EVs can be trickle-charged with a normal plug and cable, a process that can take more than half a day, why worry when we still had 61% and were in a country with more charging points than mushrooms? Next morning, after a leisurely start, in a public car park not far from Mont-Saint-Michel, we spotted a charging point. However, two cars were already using the machine, so Jack decided to leave it until we came back from seeing the sights. But after a good lunch, we found two different cars using the machine. "Shouldn't we wait?" I asked. "No need," Jack said. "Come on, let's go and stop worrying." Our battery was at 50%. There's some discussion as to what exactly happens when an EV battery runs out. There's a difference, it seems, between flat and dead flat. "Your EV is not just going to stop in the middle of the road," said an article when I Googled the subject. "The car will do everything it can to get you to a charging point." Ah, that cleared that up then. We drove up the coast of the Koh Tantan Peninsula, checked into our new lodgings, and set out to find a charging point. It was 8 at night. The battery icon said 23%. We followed the GPS and arrived at a shopping centre. It helps no one to recite the language used when Jack realised that this particular charger plug was not compatible with his car. So we bought wine in boxes and returned to our digs. Next day, on 19%, wearing overcoats, we set out driving very slowly for Cherbourg. No heater, demister, lights or radio. Guided by the screen, we detoured to a tiny hill village, Les Pieux. It was raining heavily as we crawled uphill and eventually found a rusting yellow EV charger behind the town hall. Many EV charging points won't take your credit card until you first download an app. Standing beside Les Pieux's corroding charger, I rang a number on the box and explained to someone that we hadn't time to download an app because we were rushing to catch a ferry. "No dice, monsieur," a man's voice said. "You must download the app." He then hung up. Speechless, we resumed our journey. Jack tried not to check his dashboard. In Cherbourg, we were the last vehicle to board. The ship's charging points were on another deck. Our battery was at 6%. We headed for the bar. If the battery runs out, the vehicle will go into preservation mode, the car's handbook said. Remain calm. Calmness was a challenge next morning as we slunk out of Dublin Port and entered the north bore of the port tunnel on 3%. A terrifying vista loomed, a major traffic incident. Suddenly a robotic voice inside the car began to bark, "Urgent! Stop the car! You have no battery remaining!" But we drove on as this robot bawled at us and climbed onto the M50 and chugged along for 5 more kilometres until, glory be to God, we reached Jack's house. "See, I told you we'd do it in one charge," he said with a sheepish grin. "I want to save the planet. I really do," I thought as I got into my beautiful, reliable diesel banger and fled. But surely, surely there must be easier ways to do it.
Picture the scene. Boston, September 1912. A busy dock. Men and women bustling about, cases and trunks strewn everywhere. Among them, Eleanor Frost, with her 4 children. Leslie, aged 13. Carol, 10. Irma, aged 9. And Marjorie, who's 7. Her husband, Robert Frost, stands slightly apart, scribbling something in a notebook. The children shout at him to hurry as people begin to gather their belongings to board the huge teeming liner. On deck, surrounded by the vast Atlantic Ocean, Eleanor and Robert smile as they watch the children exploring. There is a new liveliness in their eyes, the hope of a fresh start. This decision, to uproot the family and leave America for a new life in England, was made on the toss of a coin. After 10 days, the liner arrives in Glasgow. It is early morning and the silver light shimmers over the cold black city. On the train to London, the children stare as green fields and hamlets, church steeples and hedgerows rush by the dust-clad windows. They are entranced by the funny way people talk. From Euston Station, the family take a cab to Russell Square. The hotel they have booked is slightly seedy, a bit shabby, but they are charmed by woolen blankets, metal teapots, a lobby that smells of soup. In the evenings, Eleanor and Robert go to see plays, leaving Leslie in charge. After years of marriage, they are holding hands like lovers again. During the day, while Robert searches for somewhere for the family to live, Eleanor takes the children on the red buses. Leslie joins in with the others, saying unfamiliar words over and over until they break into laughter. Wellington, sweets, Piccadilly, pavement. They move into a comfortable 5-bedroom house called the Bungalow, 20 miles north of London in Buckinghamshire. There's no furniture, but they make do with odds and ends they pick up second hand, and those precious items they brought with them from home, Robert's heavy typewriter, Eleanor's rocking chair, a trunk of books. 6 months go by. There's a sense of settling. Rhythm imposes itself on the short days of winter and on the longer days of spring. In the mornings, Robert writes, while Eleanor busies herself in the kitchen. The children go to school, and in the afternoons, they play in the garden. At 38, Robert is an imposing man, but his face has a worn look from the kind of hardships that can drain joy from life, a failing farm, the frustrations of teaching, the rejection of all but a handful of the poems he has submitted to magazines. But Eleanor keeps at her husband to make a go of it now. On his forays into London, Robert attends readings, meets other poets in bookshops, Ezra Pound, W.B. Yeats, and one day, with renewed confidence, he takes his manuscript to a publishing house. The woman who accepts the parcel, bound in brown paper, offers not much hope. He catches the bus home. And then it happens. A letter. It arrives at breakfast. Robert reads it aloud more than once. Eleanor takes the thick, creamy paper in her hands, stares at it, checks the words are real. Happy to publish, it says. Very good terms. We'd like to publish your next four books. There is one final scene. It takes place on a bitter day in February in the second year of the Great War. Once again, Eleanor, Robert, and the children stand on a dock waiting to board a liner, but this time to take them back to America. At 15, Leslie no longer runs around with the other children. She is more curious about her own future. When she dies in 1983, her obituary in the New York Times describes her as an author of children's books and a lecturer in English literature. It also mentions that she was the last surviving child of the great American poet and national celebrity Robert Frost, who had recited at the inauguration of John F. Kennedy. What a lifetime ago it must have seemed to her at the end. The years in England, when her father, at nearly 40, published his first collection of poetry.
Philip Love was the last private owner of Marley House before it was bought by Dublin City Council in the 70s. He was a market gardener, a horse breeder, and at one point the largest tomato producer in Ireland. He is most well known as the owner of the horse Larkspur, who seemingly came from nowhere to win the Epsom Derby in 1962. This is a poem imagining his life in the house. Naming the Foals. It is the darkest time of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, months before the growing season, and I am casting about for names. The birth date is always January 1st. A name must be found before February of the second year. Six names, listed in order of preference, for someone else to decide. Each name, no more than 18 characters, no initials, no trade names, no numbers, except those above 30, and only if spelled out. No name that's already in use or that's ever been named. No words like colt or filly. No racetracks or famous winners. I carry a book for writing down names as they come to me, when pruning back the winter garden, glancing at the clock, pouring a drink. Sudden Flight, Traveler's Hymn, Blind Faith, Praise the Painter, Second Harvest, Merchant's Dream, Constant Optimist. Thank you.
On February the 3rd, 1959, a plane took off from Mason City Municipal Airport, Iowa. It flew into a snowstorm and crashed in Clear Lake, Iowa. The pilot and three passengers were tragically killed. News soon emerged that the three passengers were the pop stars Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and J.P. Richardson, better known as the Big Bopper. This news was received with great sadness by my friends and myself, teenagers in the village of Duyark in County Mayo. We were passionate about the new sounds of rock and roll and pop music and sought out any opportunities to hear it. And sometime later, we were deeply moved by the song Three Stars by Tommy D, which lamented the death of the three singers and placed them among the stars in heaven. The Coral Record Company took a more commercial view and released a record by Buddy Holly called It Doesn't Matter Anymore, which he'd recorded the previous year. This record climbed steadily up the UK charts, getting to number one in late April of 59, where it stayed for 4 weeks, beating off the likes of Elvis and Ricky Nelson. Ireland didn't have pop charts at that time, but for us it was without doubt the song of the summer of 1959. And that same summer, when I was visiting Belmullet for a fair day on the 15th of August, there it was, playing in a little shop which had recently had a jukebox installed. The place was packed, and music played all day, funded by teenagers home from England and Scotland with their families. This was heaven on earth to me, up-to-date pop music playing non-stop. There was Elvis with Jailhouse Rock, All Shook Up and I Got Stung. Buddy had Peggy Sue and Oh Boy, Cliff Richard with Living Doll, and Lonnie Donegan with an old favourite called Nobody Loves Like an Irishman. As I walked away from the music, I promised myself I would find a way to get back there. Now, Belmullet was a 14-mile bike ride from home, not a journey to be taken without good reason. A full 3 months later, our elderly neighbour, who had been living alone since the death of his sister, was diagnosed with a heart condition and was admitted to the hospital in the town. I was quick to volunteer to pay him a visit. Sunday was the day set for the visit, so it was mass, something to eat, and I was on my way. First stop was the hospital, where I found our neighbour, all the better for his few days of good care. I made my way from there to the shop with the jukebox. I was relieved to find the place open, as the only light was that coming from the machine itself. The place was empty, in contrast to my last visit in August. But I could see that there had been a new addition to the record selection. I took the 5 plays for 1 shilling option. It had to be Buddy Holly for my first play. I selected It Doesn't Matter Anymore. Afterwards, I considered playing it a second time, but the B-side looked promising. A song called Raining in My Heart. I picked it for my next play and was greatly moved by this sad ballad with its haunting backing music. When the song had finished, I left the shop and wandered about the town for a little while in a private haze, the music still playing in my head. It wasn't long until I found myself back in front of the jukebox for another go. The combination of those melancholy lyrics with Holly's fresh young voice was poignant, all the more so knowing his tragic end. I played Raining in My Heart again and again until my money ran out, memorizing as much of it as I could, particularly lines like, Oh, misery, misery, what's going to become of me? It was time to go. I left Belmullet and started my journey home, singing the song over and over to myself as I pedaled. By the time I had cycled the first 3 miles, turning south at Glencastle, it was not only raining in my heart, but also raining into my face. I pedaled on, humming line after line, and by the time I got home, I was soaked but happy. I had my party piece for the next time a group of us would get together, and as it turned out, we all met up on that very same night. Surrounded by my friends, I was the star turn, just like Buddy Holly.
The sun is out, the sky is blue, there's not a cloud to spoil the view, but it's raining, raining in my heart. The weatherman says clear to
you can never get Ireland right. Don Bosco's anchor from the failed Armada fleet was still stuck in the low-tide shoreline of Inishbofin, so my day trip to the island must have been long before the OPW finally winched it away to some dry dock interpretive museum. The bishop was supposed to have arrived there by boat that same morning at the head of the traditional flotilla, but he came instead by helicopter, which rankled with the locals. The sacrament of confirmation, however few the cluster of candidates, deserved a bit more pizzazz from the busy prelate. School was still in session, so it must have been early summer in the dying decades of the 20th century. Two boys with old-style leather satchels were sitting on a dry stone wall, watching a donkey foal in broad daylight, her grey balloon of slather and mucus on the magnified grass. Across from Cromwell's fort, where monks and friars had perished in a prototype gulag, surfboards lay among curraghs on the narrow strand, and the island priest waded with others into the ebb water, up to the knee bump of his own cassock, to help launch a large clinkered rowboat with an outboard engine. Down in the dry hotel, it was less Liam O'Flaherty and more merrily postmodern. A Munster friend of mine, a former Dominican novice master who had coached Viv Richards' underarm bowling at a Trinidadian college in the 60s, was prayer matting there cheerfully with his sweetheart, a middle-aged medical missionary from Limerick, whom the Nigerian authorities had arrested and deported during the civil war in Biafra. They were the first enthusiasts to tell me of Thich Nhat Hanh, a celebrity Buddhist monk of mindfulness, in whose name they were gathered in a teetotal ground-floor room among like-minded folk for a breakaway ashram and an out-of-bounds binge after hours. On the quayside beyond, an artist at his easel assessed the reliable sunshine and set to work in his beard and beret. Women in leggings passed him as he blocked in black what seemed to be a shawl, but would now be a stab at a wetsuit or a kneecap on a rigid, inflatable raft. Up above in the church, the bishop, God bless him, was preaching on the perils of drug addiction to a sparse scatter of children awaiting the descent of the spirit, the soulful stirrings of puberty, and an expat adulthood in Adelaide or Edmonton. The priest of the parish had swapped his drenched cassock in the sacristy for a Latin lacework and looked crestfallen. A felt pen, bold font note on restoration funds in the porch of the building read, "There is an ulcer of dampness in our church." The writing was on the wall already. But I went outside into a North Atlantic brightness to chat with the helicopter pilot. I'd given up smoking and so stood downwind in the slipstream of his Winston cigarette. He was an Irish countryman who had gained his American passport by military service in Vietnam, flying gunships on air assaults in the Mekong.